Welcome to this lecture, jointly organized by Oxford and the Center for Analysis of Risk and Regulation here at LSE. This center is an interdisciplinary research unit. If you want to learn more about us, we have some magazines there which you can look at and take with you. If you have something to read while you're waiting for delayed bus in the heat, and I hope you'll have a good read. One of our key themes in the past 3 years has been a theme called regulation in crisis with a question mark. And it very much goes back to one of the first events that we organized when I sort of took over as a director of PR, which was on utilities regulation to think about. It was 30 years of student literature. At the time, I remember distinctly, Catherine was there, I put up a slide and said, British utility regulation, age of fiasco. And the whole room was aghast, and outraged, or thought he was an academic gesture making comments. But I think whatever one thinks about age of fiasco, I think utility regulation in the last 3 years has been quite a prominent kind of theme. Questions about exactly what today's topic, independent economic regulation, have been central in the past election campaign, as well, but who knows when that will happen. And therefore, it is really a wonderful opportunity that what's here, who comes back as an MSc alumni to this institution. Catherine, as you know, is chief executive of Ofwat, but also has experiences with very regulation and also the competition commission. So it is kind of time to think about it, this kind of topic. I should also say the podcast will be hopefully recording while we are sort of going through this evening, so this is on the record, so to speak. Catherine will speak about sort of for 35 minutes or so, and then there's time for question and answers, and then afterwards we can relax or continue heated discussions over a glass of wine and a few snacks. So, Catherine, thank you very, very much for joining us, and we're all looking forward to listening to you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Martin. I was thinking about whether I should sit down for this. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to stand up, not least so that you will know when I finish, which will be when I sit down again. So, as Martin said, I'm going to talk for around 35 minutes, and I just want to start off by saying a massive thank you to Professor Martin Lodge and to the very much esteemed Centre for the Analysis of Risk and Regulation here at LSE for hosting me this evening. I'm a big admirer of what the Centre is doing, and I think it is genuinely really contributing to the debate about economic regulation, but also within economic regulators as well. So I'd see you very much as a critical friend in the true spirit of the word. So my topic for the lecture this evening is the future of independent economic regulation. And if you're perhaps tempted to read into that title that I think economic regulation has a future, you would be right. Although I do think it's fair to say that I think its future is going to be very different to its past. And my starting point in the analysis that I want to set out for you is that it makes no sense to think about the future of independent economic regulation in isolation, because it is, and always was, part of a wider system of governance around a set of essential public services that are provided by the private sector. And I'm going to refer to that in a shorthand form as public utilities throughout this lecture, although I know that that does brush over some of the complexity of what these sectors do, but it's a useful shorthand. So in thinking about the future of independent economic regulation, it only really makes sense to think about that in the context of thinking about how that whole system is evolving, and then to think about what that means for independent economic regulation. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start off with a very brief recap about the context in which independent economic regulators were set up in the UK. And I'm going to give what I know is a really broad brush overview of that governance system that was put in around public utilities around the time of privatisation. So having given something of an idea of our starting point, I then want to talk about some of the key changes to that system. I want to talk about changes around what that system is there to achieve, I want to talk about changes in some of the roles of the key players within that system. And then I also want to talk a little bit about changes in the nature of the system itself. And then I want to sum up by discussing some of the implications of this for independent economic regulation and some of the challenges and opportunities that brings for those of us in independent regulators. So, before I get into any of that, I just want to spend a little bit of time doing some ground clearing. Now, I know, and I remember this from my academic days, that any good essay about independent economic regulation would start by defining this as a key term. Well, I'm not going to do that, because as I think you'll see throughout the lecture that I'm going to give, I think the very essence of what independent economic regulation is changing. So if I was going to define it up front, it would pretty much defeat the purpose of my talk. But what I do want to make clear is that I am going to talk here exclusively about what's going on in the UK. I know independent economic regulation has been rolled out across the globe now, but I am going to talk here about the UK. And I am, as I said, I'm going to talk about independent economic regulation as it applies to public utilities. And remember, I know that's a shorthand. But I do know the bounds of economic regulation are set higher and wider than public utilities these days, and I'm sure that a lot of the points that I'm making will be relevant for some of the newer frontiers in economic regulation. But nevertheless, in developing my thinking, I've been thinking about the more traditional applications in public utility sectors. And then I should also make clear that where I'm coming from with this is very much a practitioner's perspective. So again, if you are expecting an erudite academic treatise, now is the time to leave. But I do hope that what I'm going to say is going to be no less useful for that. And you'll probably be familiar with one of my favourite quotes from David Newbury, who said back in 1997 that in regulation, and I quote, "practice, which is evolving rapidly, continues to outstrip theory, providing challenges to the economics profession in modelling, testing and proposing superior and workable alternatives." End quote. So maybe there'll be one or two challenges from the perspective that I'm offering tonight. A final piece of ground clearing that I ought to do is to make clear that this is not intended to be any grand state of the nation piece. I've got fairly modest aims here. All I'm trying to do is observe some of the changes that I see as happening in and around independent economic regulation and try and distill from that some of the key points and share my thinking about what that might mean. So that's all I'm trying to do. Right, so let's get into the meat of it. So I'm going to start off, as I said, by recapping on what I see as the broad brush characteristics of the original model for independent economic regulation in the UK. And I'm doing that because I think to understand where regulation is going, we do need to pause for a moment on where it came from. An independent economic regulation was the solution to a very particular problem at a very particular time. And in public policy terms, the thinking was inextricably bound up with privatisation and competition. The failings of state-owned industries, especially through the 1970s, were widely recognised even at the time as being linked to their ownership structures. And in contrast, there was a feeling that shareholders would respond to the incentives that they faced to create value in their companies, that company boards would respond to shareholders by creating incentives on management and instilling private sector management disciplines. And the result would be greater efficiency and better service with no recourse to the public purse. And the introduction of a new governance model within public utility companies was complemented by a new governance model around those companies, in which independent economic regulators were to play a key role. In some of those sectors and in some parts of the value chain, it was envisaged that competition would serve to align the interests of shareholders and customers. And here, the role of regulators was primarily to promote competition. In other sectors, and I include here water, where competition wasn't originally envisaged, and in other natural monopoly parts of the value chain, commonly known as pipes and wires, and also in areas where competition had not yet taken hold, the regulatory framework was intended to act more directly to align the interests of shareholders with those of customers. Regulators would set price controls that included an efficiency challenge, but would leave scope for companies to profit by outperformance and reveal new efficiency frontiers that would benefit customers at the next review. Regulators would set standards and enforce obligations such that firms not complying would again feel the force of financial penalties. Government wasn't absent from this governance model. but it did operate at one step removed. The policy framework of privatisation, competition and regulation was owned by government. Government proposed the legislative framework, which was enacted by Parliament, that enabled the privatisations to happen, that created economic regulators and gave them their statutory duties, principally the promotion of competition and the protection of consumers. But government understood that if privatisation were to succeed, the incentives and private sector management disciplines it relied on needed to be given space to play out. And it also understood that day-to-day government intervention would therefore be unhelpful. It understood that government needed a credible pre-commitment strategy to avoid investors and company management simply factoring in what they would see as inevitable government intervention, which would at best hamper those private managers from really delivering the better service and efficiency the privatisations were aimed at, and would at worst undermine the viability of these new companies as investment propositions. And so, economic regulators were created as independent of government. Now, independence never meant unaccountable. Reflecting the importance of public utilities for the whole of our society and economy, regulators were created accountable to Parliament, crucially Parliament rather than government. And this quite reasonably gave our democratically elected representatives a mechanism to convey their views about what regulators were doing and what they were delivering, while avoiding undermining the benefits of independence from government. And the regulators' decisions were subject to both judicial review and, in some cases, such as price controls, specialist appeals on the merits. So, crudely characterised, and I accept this as a crude characterisation, in their original conception, regulators were charged with promoting competition and protecting consumers, and they could broadly rely on the power of financial incentives acting on shareholders, who would then align their own interests with those of company management to make stuff happen. And they were very largely left to get on with it by government. So, if that was the past, where's the future taking us? Well, I want to talk about three drivers for change here that stem from changes that are taking place in that whole system of governance. And I think they have profound implications for the role of independent economic regulators within that system. I want to talk first about what I see as a shift in the public policy purpose of that whole system of governance. And then I want to talk about a shift in the roles and responsibilities of the various actors within that system and what the implications have for independent economic regulation. And then I want to talk about the changing nature of the dynamics across the system as a whole. So let me start off by talking about that shift in the public policy purpose of the whole system of governance around public utilities. Because that's probably the most profound shift that I'm seeing, and it drives an awful lot of other things as well. And I want to be clear before I get into it that I'm not talking here about changes in regulator statutory duties. Some of them have changed, some of them have changed more than others. But what I'm talking about here is rather a shift in what the public is looking for from these critical service sectors and about how it expects to see those things delivered. Now, you can read much better informed and more eloquent commentators on the referendum result and indeed the recent election result than I. But I think we are seeing in many parts of political and economic life right now people asking some really very fundamental questions about the sort of society and the sort of economy we want to be. And I'm referring to society and the economy together, by the way, because I just don't think they make any sense considered apart. I'm not a fan of the idea that economic policy should somehow be left to expert economists and is distinct from social policy, which more rightly has a political dimension. I think that distinction is just bunk, but we might come back to that in discussion. At some point, we may have a government that wants to revisit the whole question of private provision of public utilities, and in fact, we got rather closer to that in the last election than many of us thought we would. But even absent that, this shift in the public debate has given some regulators, and us at Ofwat included, pause for thought. At Ofwat, it's prompted us to go back to first principles, to look beyond our statutory duties and into the wider public policy context in which we operate, and ask ourselves the big question, what are we here for? Which, we concluded, is ultimately to ensure that the public have trust and confidence in water and wastewater services, which are privately provided. That's our vision for the sector, and it's why our strategy at Ofwat is called Trust in Water. Yes, enabling and incentivising efficiency is a huge part of that, and so is holding companies to account for complying with the law and delivering against their promises to customers. but even in respect of what customers and society get from their service providers, it's about much more than that. Because now more than ever, people's expectations are rising. The products and services they expect are changing, becoming more personalised, more targeted, more reflective of their needs. We do not live today in a society where a regulator can hope to do enough by doing some customer research, writing some service standards, and introducing a licence obligation against companies to deliver on them. Regulation needs to inform, enable, and incentivise genuine innovation. And we need to look beyond this too, because it isn't just the what that matters for trust and confidence, it's the how. The relationships that service providers have with their customers matter enormously. The extent to which they are part of the communities they serve, the extent to which customers and wider society feel their service providers are accountable. And if people look at the governance structures within these companies and look at what they're reporting against and don't feel confident that those companies are operating in the public interest, they worry. That trust and confidence, which is such a fragile thing, gets chipped away. So if you replace consumer surplus or even total welfare as the regulator's maximum with trust and confidence, you get a very different regulatory model. Value for money and holding to account against obligations remain a critical part of it. That trust and confidence does need to be grounded in reality and not a PR exercise. And there are some drivers of trust and confidence, especially where they're linked to things like distributional fairness, that I think regulators should be wary of and leave to others, such as government. But there's no doubt that taking trust and confidence as our purpose does suggest a broader remit and a wider toolkit. And it crucially takes us beyond any idea that in order to make regulation more effective, all we need is more better quality data and a bigger spreadsheet to put it in. Right, as I said before, if the public policy purpose of that whole system of governance around public utilities is shifting, it has big implications for the roles and responsibilities of different actors in that system. And I want to talk about those changes now, and I'll take different actors in turn. And I want to start off talking about government. Why am I starting off talking about government? Well, I'm conscious that a lot of debate in regulatory circles focuses on what is seen as a more activist role that's being taken by government now. And it can, I admit, sometimes sound as though the regulatory community feels rather threatened by this. You hear discussions sometimes about how those in government circles, and I don't just mean the politicians, but the officials too, have somehow forgotten about why we have independent economic regulation and about how we need to do a better job in reminding them all of its achievements and strengths. And there may well be an element of truth to this, but it rather misses what I think is the big point. If as a country we're asking ourselves what sort of society and economy we want to be, it's hardly surprising we're seeing government taking a keener interest and involvement in questions of both what gets delivered and how it gets delivered. And when it comes to questions of things like nationally strategic infrastructure investment, when it comes to questions about distributional impacts, these are questions that involve major externalities, both as between different parts of our economy and society and between generations. So there is a space here that government needs to fill. And frankly, it seems odd to me that government was as absent as it was for so long. With public utilities delivering substantial improvements in service and investment with no pull on the public purse, and with relatively benign economic conditions, you can see why government through the 1990s perhaps didn't see a need to intervene. And I can also see why they might have been concerned not to do any injury to the independent economic regulatory goose that was laying the golden egg. But these are politically salient sectors, and there are issues here that seem entirely appropriate for our democratically elected representatives to have a view on, and very possibly a say in. There's no doubt that government today is taking a more active role, and as a result, there is a different interface now between government and regulators, and we need to get used to it, and we need to work with government to figure out our respective roles. The legislative framework exists now for most economic regulators to get what's called a strategic policy statement from government. We were the first regulator to get one at Ofwat back in 2012. And what they do is set out very clearly, very transparently, what government sees as the principal high-level priorities for regulation of the sector. We've also now got the National Infrastructure Commission, which is an executive agency of the Treasury. And that takes a national strategic view on infrastructure need, and regulators are required to have regard to this in their work. These are really significant changes, but ultimately, for me, they're welcome ones. because they acknowledge the role that government rightly has in these sectors and provide transparency around the interface with independent regulators. And of course, it's worth remembering, there's more government now than there was at the time of privatisations. We have devolved administrations in Scotland and in Wales with increasing powers and their own policy identities, which are very much distinct from those of the UK government in Westminster. We've got great examples of this in water, for example, where the Scottish government, and you might know that the Scottish government has a publicly owned incumbent water company and its own regulator. The Scottish government introduced retail competition for business customers 9 years ago. The UK government brought forward legislation to do this in England in 2014, and we opened the market this year. But we have a Welsh government that has said it's unconvinced of the benefits of competition. And that's the most obvious example I can think of. But there are subtle differences in policy context too in the devolved administrations. And of course they do expect to be able to hold us to account for reflecting those in our work. And of course we're barely at the foothills as far as the potential for greater regional government and localism goes in England. We've had a mayor in London for many years now, but we now have mayors across city regions. And it remains to be seen how we can expect them to influence what people in businesses in their areas experience from the sectors that we regulate, and how they will expect us to demonstrate how we've taken their views into account too. So I'm going to move on from talking about government. I'm going to talk a little bit about companies now. And I think for all the time, and I am absolutely as guilty as anyone here, we spend talking about the role of government, I'm not sure it is actually the most significant role in this whole governance system. So let's talk a little bit about companies now. It is true that the requirements on company directors these days are wider than they once were. Boards, and I'm referring here to corporate law and the UK Corporate Governance Code, are explicitly charged with responsibility for the, and I quote, long-term success of the company, and directors are required now to have regard to wider stakeholder matters beyond the narrow interests of their investors. But I think it's fair to say that there is a lot further to go on this. And I think investors are absolutely key. They have a key role through boards in ensuring companies have the right leadership. And similarly, they play a key role through boards in motivating those leaders through remuneration and wider opportunities. And investors need to realise that in these vital public service sectors, the long-term sustainability of their investment rests on the demonstrable legitimacy of their companies. In short, I think we need to see more enlightened self-interest here. Now, we are seeing movement on this, and I think we have seen investors in the water sector, for example, increasingly recognising the point about the importance of legitimacy, although it may be somewhat tempting to observe that it took the regulator, in particular with the arrival of our chairman, Johnson Cox, a few years ago, to take that conversation to the investors. And there is still more to do to get beyond what I call payment of lip service into a position where investors and company boards genuinely see the alignment of their own interests with those of the public interest, and where we see that flow right the way through the company through governance and reward structures. And for those of you who are familiar perhaps with the thinking on ethical regulation, and I have to say I'm a fan of that, I do think this is a critical factor for the success of that model of regulation. And maybe again it's something we can pick up in discussion later on. Okay, so I've talked about changing role of government, I've talked a bit about changing role of companies. I now want to talk a little bit about the changing role of customers and citizens in that system of governance. And I think the role of both of these groups, and they are to some extent distinct, has changed enormously and matters greatly. I want to talk about customers first. And I think the changes here have been somewhat paradoxical when you think about it through the lens of what was expected in many of these sectors at the time of privatisation. Competition was intended to empower customers. Competitive markets would make companies directly accountable to them, giving them the ultimate sanction to vote with their feet if they didn't like price or the service they were offered. We now know a little bit more about how utility markets work, and while there are some products that really get customers excited and engaged, there are many others that aren't so exciting, and most of public utilities tend to fall into the latter group, especially where the complexity of products and tariffs, possibly coupled with some bad experiences that people have had in the market themselves, just causes people to switch off. There is evidence to suggest that customers overall are better off as a result of competition, but unsurprisingly, those who don't engage do not get as good a deal as those who do. And there is no doubt that the difference in the experience between those who engage and get the best deal and those who don't is increasingly seen as unacceptable. especially if those who get the best deals are being subsidised by those who get the worst. And it's a situation that just does not deliver on that redefined public policy goal for the whole system of trust and confidence. So where we have competition in utility markets, maybe regulators should expect a little less from customers and perhaps be more prepared to stay involved. Certainly, I think regulators need to pay close attention to the need to build customer trust in competitive markets and build their confidence to engage. There's another different relationship emerging there. But going back to my paradox, in those sectors and those parts of the value chain where there is persistent monopoly, we're seeing customers taking a bigger role as regulators encourage companies to deploy more customer engagement to improve allocative efficiency, using their scarce resources to do more of what matters for customers and society, but also to increase accountability and build trust. And at Ofwat, we've said that we would like to go beyond this and see greater customer participation in the sector, with customers involved in co-creating visions of the future with companies and involved in co-delivering them too. I talked at the start of this section about customers and citizens, and it's clearly very important to involve not only bill payers in this sort of engagement and participation. How water and wastewater companies provide services to customers has a huge impact on the environment, for example, and engagement on that is important too. And other aspects of what companies do, not only in respect of the environment, but also major infrastructure investment, have a big impact on future generations as well. So there are clearly limits to the extent to which customer and citizen engagement and participation can work in the sector. Not all citizens, not all customers will want to be engaged, let alone participate. And I think we're already seeing an increasingly competitive market for what you might call customer and citizen bandwidth. And it's also true that not all aspects of regulation are suitable for this approach. The challenge that we bring on the basis of the information and expertise that we have is always going to be important. And I don't think it would be a great idea to outsource the weighted average cost of capital, for example. But customer engagement and customer participation in price reviews is a huge improvement in legitimacy terms over where we were a few years ago. And again, another aspect of that different relationship between some of the key players in the system. Okay, so I've talked a bit about what I see as the shift in the public policy purpose of the whole governance system around public utilities. And I've said something about the shifting roles of some of the actors within that system. And I just want to say a little bit about the changing nature of the dynamics within the system. So I could characterise that original system of governance in the immediate sort of post-privatisation period as a rather linear, rather top-down transmission mechanism. Government set the policy framework that enabled private investors to come in and own public utilities, and enabled regulators to set their policy framework, which alongside the incentives investors placed on management determined what the company did, which determined what customers got. But what we've got now is much less linear, much more multidimensional and much more multidirectional. Yes, government sets the policy framework, but it may also have things to say about the specifics of what gets built and about the prices that customers pay. Yes, the investors do determine the incentives placed on management, but those incentives are much more open to scrutiny by regulators, by customers, and by civil society groups. Yes, regulators do still set incentive frameworks, but they also encourage processes that involve customers. Yes, we still hold companies to account for price and service, but we also pay attention to culture and governance within the company so that we can focus our attention on where it's really needed. And we encourage transparency so that others have a role in holding companies to account too. And we increasingly see customers and NGOs doing just that. Yes, customers and citizens do still receive services from regulated service providers, but they're more involved in shaping those services, in designing and delivering the future, and in holding service providers to account. It's a very much more dynamic and porous system, much more dynamic and porous of an environment in which regulators work. So what does all of this mean then for the future of independent economic regulation? Well, the good news, at least from my perspective as a regulator, is I think independent economic regulation actually has a very bright future. The core purpose of independent economic regulation, that core purpose that has remained constant, the driving of efficiency and better service in privately provided public service utilities, remains. And the toolkit that we have for doing that, notwithstanding there is perennially scope for improvement, at its heart works very effectively at doing some of the things that really matter in respect of this core purpose, enabling investment and driving value for money. But more than that, even acknowledging the wider public policy purpose of the whole system of governance, the importance of trust and confidence in these critically important sectors and the service they provide, I think independent economic regulation offers some solutions, especially if regulators are unafraid to use their wider toolkit and focus not only on what customers get, but also on the relationships between service providers, customers, and society, and pay proper attention to the long-term dynamics within sectors. In short, I see big opportunities for independent economic regulation to help build trust and confidence in public utilities, and also to help others who I'm assuming are feeling their way in this evolving system of governance as much as we are, to play their part effectively as well. We do face some challenges, of course, and from where I sit, there are four of them that I want to draw out. The first of those is around successfully redefining our relationship with government. And that starts with being seen by government as part of the solution rather than the problem. And I think we're in a good place on that. But we do need to perhaps establish a more mature relationship than we had in the past, and a relationship that sees us acknowledging that the sectors we regulate are politically salient, that government will have things to say and quite properly will have interventions to make, which sees us help government to do what it's trying to do in these sectors transparently and with the benefit of our expertise, but which gives us permission to be a critical friend rather than a cheerleader. Because let's face it, economic history is littered with examples of quite possibly well-intentioned government interventions in markets that were not an unalloyed success. And I think regulators should have permission to challenge and question in this space. Crucially, we need a relationship that maintains our ability to set out and operate our regulatory frameworks on the basis of statute, so that investors and management can bring their expertise to our sectors to the benefit of customers, and which sees us really doing our job effectively and being seen to do our job effectively, so that government does not feel the need to intervene on a remedial basis. The second challenge we face is around redefining our role with respect to customers. In competitive markets, we need to stay more involved than we might once have thought. We need to keep an eye on whether competition is really effective and on how we can improve it. But more than that, we need to keep an eye on whether those markets are delivering for customers, not just on average, but across different groups of customers. And if they aren't, we will need, quite possibly working with government, to figure out whether that needs intervention and what intervention is needed. And in respect of monopolistic markets, we need to stay focused on customer engagement and participation, but also challenge companies to keep up with increasingly fast-paced changes in customer expectations about products and services, and about how customers access these, and indeed about communications more generally. And the third challenge is about redefining our role in respect of the companies that we regulate. I think economic regulators need to be very much more demanding of companies in terms of expectations, not only on service and the customer experience more broadly, but on things like corporate governance and transparency. But we need to be demanding in a different way. We need to be clearer at the macro level about the immense responsibilities that these companies, and indeed their investors in these public service sectors, have, especially where they have the privilege of monopoly. And we need to be much less willing, I think, to step in at the micro level and tell them exactly what to do and how to do it. Because I've seen in water that that micro-level intervention across a whole sector, while it may well have been appropriate in those early years following privatisation, over time just infantilises the sector. And rather than provoking and challenging and holding to account, the regulator ends up providing a safety net for companies. And that isn't what we should be doing at all. Finally, I think we have a big challenge in challenging ourselves. Part of this is about staying connected with those we serve, not losing sight of what matters to customers and citizens, not losing sight of the realities of life for people. And to be clear, I'm not talking here about going backwards towards regulators doing giant customer surveys and telling companies what to do. I'm just talking about the fact that we are experts. And that's a good thing. A big part of our toolkit's pretty technical, and we need our expertise to use it as effectively as we can. But we do need to stay grounded. And another part of this challenge is that we need not to be defensive. Part of this is about challenging ourselves on policies and approaches to learn from what's worked and also from what hasn't. And it also perhaps includes not being defensive of the institutional structure we all work in. Now, I'm not generally a big fan of structural change, and too often it seems to me to meet cosmetic demands for, quote, something to be done, while achieving very little beyond additional cost and distraction. But as I talk about the need to redefine our relationship with customers and with companies, it does strike me that we need to reflect on the world as customers and those who provide services to them increasingly see it. And that's a world of multi-utility bundles. It's a world of connected home services and a rather more holistic view of the customer as a human being living a multidimensional life rather than as a water bill payer or a telecoms bill payer or an energy bill payer. And at the very least, I think we're going to need to work much more closely together to ensure that customers are properly protected and service providers do not face undue barriers in competing across sectors. Now, I'm not saying structural change is the only way to do that, but I do think we ought to be open-minded about it. So on structures, policies, and approaches, we need to stay open and curious, and we need to seek out the maverick voices so that we don't drown in self-congratulatory groupthink. But from what I can see, regulators are pretty conscious of those challenges and are working really hard on them. And I do think we have a really valuable mutual support network through the UK Regulators Network, which really helps us think through these challenges and opportunities together, learning from each other. So, to conclude, it is with a genuine feeling of optimism that I look forward to seeing what independent economic regulation, as part of this ever-evolving system of public utility governance, will deliver for our society and economy over the next 30 years. And maybe Martin will invite me back for a retirement gig.
Which the World Bank at the time thought was the most outrageous thing to do, and now is seen as a success. Subsequent governments always want to split off telecom, sort of a spectrum organisation, but there are clearly sort of models out there, and that we will go to Jamaica in the future. But I will not talk here, so I will just sort of moderate questions. So we have about half an hour, so if you have questions, please. Wave hands and the microphone will come your way.
Thank you. I can. Thank you, Catherine, for your comments. I'm Alex Park from Anglian Water. I made some closing remarks at the Centre for Competition Policy Conference last week, where one of the points I made was that issues such as distributional fairness should be left to government, not regulators. I just wondered, and the point I made then was that the democratic sort of accountability that sits properly with government sort of means that government is uniquely able to make those sorts of decisions, and it's very hard for an economic regulator without that sort of democratic mandate to do so. I wonder whether, apart from distributional equity, there are other facets that you would put firmly in government's more rather than in the regulators.
It's a really good question. I mean, I think on the point about distributional issues, you can hear from what I said, but in principle I agree with you that it is rightly the preserve of democratically elected governments, and although we are accountable to Parliament, we don't have the same level of legitimacy democratically as government does. In practice, as you know, it isn't quite that simple. And there are all sorts of decisions that we take and that companies take that do have distributional impacts. So I don't think we should be too precious about facing up to the fact that we do need to consider distributional issues in some of the decisions that we take, albeit that the big picture ones are probably rightly best left for government. The other things that I had in mind when I was talking about things that government might rightly wish to have a say in were the sorts of things that, it goes back to my theme really, that are critically important in determining what sort of a society and economy we have. And I think this is why I'm very supportive, for example, of the work that the National Infrastructure Commission is doing, because I think there they are raising some really fundamental questions about, you know, what sort of economy are we, do we want to be? Where is our economic growth and productivity going to come from? What are the key strategic investments that are needed in order to deliver that? And I think those are, you know, they are questions that are not capable of solving a solution within a sector context. They're not capable of being solved, you know, within a even, you know, let alone 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 year time frame. And I think those are the sorts of things where government will rightly wish to have a say. But I haven't got any other thoughts on that immediately, but those are the two obvious examples that sprang to mind.
Very much. I'm Stephen Owens from DEPRA. I was really interested in your opening remarks, Catherine, about economic regulations sitting within a broader framework of governance or a broader framework of responsibilities. I wonder if you have any reflections on the boundaries with some of the other regulators of the sector that you've worked with, and whether economic regulators should have responsibility for some of the broader regulation, be that sort of service regulation, be that environmental regulation. Where you've seen that work well, where less well.
It's interesting. I mean, Stephen knows me quite well and probably knows how some of my experience plays into this. So at the moment, obviously, I work for Ofwat. We are the water regulator. We are the economic regulator. The water sector also has a drinking water inspectorate that looks after water quality. The Environment Agency does the environmental protection regulation. So there we have multiple regulators, all with a different focus, looking at the same industry. Immediately prior to joining Ofwat, I was at the Office of Rail Regulation, very different setup. And with the Office of Rail Regulation, we did not only the economic part of regulation, but also safety. So I've seen both of the different models. I mean, I think, Stephen, I think the short answer is that it matters less where things are done than that things are done, and that they're done competently. And I think that is an overriding point. I have to say, I think my personal preference is for the model we have in water. And that is partly, I think, a reflection of me and how I like to work as much as anything else. What I think works really well in water is that you get the separation of voice, you get the clarity of conversation, you get the transparency of conversation, which I think is really valuable, because these things can pull in different directions sometimes. And that's okay, and we just need to thrash that out and have the conversation and bring the best evidence and analysis we can and come to a sensible solution. And I think it's healthy to do that in the kind of transparent way that different organisations naturally bring to it. You can bring that same transparency and complementarity within the same institution, and I think ORR actually does it pretty well, but it's harder. So I think there are examples of things that work well in both systems, and I think it really matters less the structural situation than whether things are done and done well.
Mark Fitch from PA Consulting. Question on, you talked about the amount of change that's going on, and not only sort of the shifts in industries, but also regionalisation of power. How will regulators sort of be nimble on their feet to respond to the multiple, you know, disruptive business models and disruptive political power that you might see in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I might be reading this wrong, but the glint in your eye is telling me that you might have a view that regulators aren't the nimblest and fleetest of footed institutions.
No. How do you maintain that?
Okay. Well said. It is a challenge, and to be fair, it's a challenge that we've been facing with the devolved administrations in Scotland and Wales. And I think there is real cause for optimism if you look at how that's working, because I think, you know, it's taken us a little while to get our head around it, but I think there are things that are working really well. So going there, being part of the conversation, is absolutely critical. You cannot expect to stay in your office in Birmingham or stay in your office in London and presume to know what the people of the, you know, Manchester City region want. It's not going to work. You've got to go up there, you've got to be part of the conversation, you've got to hear it from the horse's mouth. And I think that's something that certainly at Ofwat we didn't quite get right with the initial phases of devolution, for example, in Wales. So that's a necessary condition. And I think coupled with that, really listening, and it goes back to that last challenge that I was setting out about being really open to different ways of doing things and hearing things that don't necessarily conform with your initial worldview. And again, I'll give you the example of the journey that we've been on with the devolved administration in Wales. There is absolutely no doubt that there is a very different flavour to the policy conversation in Wales, a very different flavour indeed, and that's okay. And those of us who are based in London or Birmingham might think it sounds a bit different. Well, yes, it does. Get over it. That's the context that you have to operate in. But you have to really listen and not just assume that you know the right answer and your job is just to turn up and explain that what you're doing is perfect and it's all fine and they don't need to worry and they need to just let you go away and get on with it. It's not going to work. And then I think the last point is about accountability, which again is a bit of a journey that we're on, but I think we're getting better at it. You know, what you have here is newly formed institutions. They are very conscious of the power that's been vested in them. They want to do good and useful things with that power. And part of that is that they want you to be accountable to them, possibly informally, but nevertheless, they want you to be accountable to them for what you are doing for people in their region. And, you know, if you think about what we've been doing, for example, in increasingly demonstrating to the Welsh Government that we are delivering for the people of Wales, that is not something that we did particularly well a few years ago. It's something that we do much better now. I'm sure if you look at what we're doing in 5 years' time, it will evolve still further. We're yet even to start that journey with the city regions, for example. So I think we've got a lot to learn. But the upside is that we have met some of these issues before, and I would hope that we will be quicker to get through that journey in relation to things like the city regions than we have been with the devolved administrations.
Thank you. Anne Robinson, independent consumer champion, I call myself these days, from Love Donuts here today. And I was very pleased about your final challenge about, you know, the holistic approach and bundled products and all the rest of it. And maybe in about 5 years' time we will see a utilities commission. That might well be the way forward. So, you know, who knows? But I'm glad to see that there's really constructive work going on. That's a comment. But an issue. I completely agree with what you said, Catherine, about trust and confidence being really quite central to a lot of all of this. And a central theme of this is going to be perceived fairness. And then that is, you know, what does that mean? Who's fairness? Now, what I'd like you to elaborate on, if you wouldn't mind, because I know it's something close to your heart, and give you an opportunity. Fairness, I think, personally, we can only arrive at that through getting full participation of society and the public to help interpret what that might mean. So how might that play out? There you are, on a plate.
Thanks, Anne. You're right. This is really interesting. Let me tell you a story that somebody once told me, and I apologise to those of you in the room who've heard this before, but I think it bears repeating. So I have a friend who was a frequent visitor to the OFT board, and recounted to me the tale of a particularly heated discussion about some enforcement case or other, which ultimately boiled down to cost allocations and whether things went one way or the other. And somebody ventured forth in this very erudite economic discussion the question of whether something was fair or not. And this caused the predictable ripple around the board table. And the general consensus of the discussion was heading towards a position that really we as the OFT, were a credible sort of authoritative competition authority, and really fairness had nothing to do with it. At which point somebody piped up and reminded them that they were called the Office of Fair Trading. The point of this is that I think, you know, notions of fairness are really difficult, okay? And they are really difficult for independent economic regulators for all the reasons that Alex has already articulated, which is that we do not have that immediate democratic accountability. So you end up concluding, well, who are we to opine on what is fair and what isn't? Which I think is actually the starting point to the answer, which I suspect I'm in agreement with you. regulators can do an awful lot to promote fairness, not necessarily by collecting lots and lots of data and working out what they think is fair and visiting that upon an unsuspecting industry, but by creating processes of engagement that, as you're saying, engage customers, NGOs, you know, other groups in civil society, so that even if, you know, people may well differ about whether the outcome is fair, and people will differ about that, we can at least get a consensus that the process that resulted in that outcome was fair. And I think if as a regulator you're achieving that, you're doing pretty well. But we've got a long journey on it.
Thanks. Heather Glass, Tidely. I've been thinking about the sort of technocratic elements, or the technical, we probably get to say, elements of regulation, and clearly they've sort of grown exponentially, if not more, in response to this sort of hiving off of regulation into independent bodies, relative to the situation under public ownership. Is there always going to be a fundamental tension between the regulator on the one hand, who has, you know, huge numbers of highly qualified and experienced staff in dealing with these technical aspects, and on the other hand, the people who are, the whole thing is accountable to the customers and to government, who really sort of want to not think about that side of things, but every now and then get kind of nervous that, oh my goodness, all this stuff is going on. Is there anything really that regulators could or should do to try and bridge that gap with regard to the more technical aspects of regulation?
It's a good question, and it's one that certainly at Ofwat we've been talking about quite a lot, because periodically you do these sort of stakeholder surveys and you go out and you ask customers, so what do you think of Ofwat? And the general response you get is who? And then you sit down and you say, well, do we care about that? And if we do, what should we be doing about it? So I think it's even more fundamental than should we do more to engage with customers and society about the technical aspects of regulation. I think there's a big question about should we do more to engage with customers and society about the fact that there are these things called regulators that do this stuff. I don't know. I mean, I think we could spend an awful lot of time and effort on it, and I'm not sure it would necessarily get us very far. But I do think the point you make about the ever-increasing sort of technocratic sophistication of the regulatory toolkit is a very good point. It's a very salutary point for us. And it's something that we paused on at Ofwat a few years ago. And I referred to it in my lecture where I was talking about us going back and revisiting what we felt our fundamental purpose was. And we were sort of, you know, we sort of looked ourselves in the mirror and said, you know, what are we here for? And I think that was a very, very important exercise, because in a sense what we'd done is we'd sort of accreted lots of different sort of gubbins within the regulatory toolkit, and the answer to each successive problem was another piece of gubbins. And then you stand back and you look at the whole system and think, hold on a minute, how the hell did we get here? And does anybody really understand it? And so by sort of repurposing ourselves and sort of really reflecting on what we were here for, and by focusing on this, as I say, wider public policy purpose of trust and confidence, it's really enabled us to go back and think about what the right tools in the toolkit are to achieve that. And of course, that is not necessarily just, you know, the technocratic gubbins of regulation. We are, for example, thinking, you know, day in, day out in everything we do about communications as a regulatory tool. It is just as effective, possibly more effective, than some of the widgety price control incentive mechanisms that we've heard. So I think, you know, I think the jury's out in my mind on whether we should do more to actually directly engage with customers and society on what we do and why we do it. We should certainly do more to engage with customers and society about what it is they are looking for, so that we can hold ourselves to account for delivering that. And I think, yes, we should stay open to challenging ourselves as to what it is we are here for, and make sure that we don't fall into that position that you can easily fall into of being too much in love with your own toolkit.
Excuse
me,
yes,
okay.
Richard Calvey. Speaking as someone who used to do enforcement at a regulator, do you think
Can you maybe talk about some of the challenges there are in terms of exactly what you were talking about there, in terms of you're trying to move to a situation where regulators and companies are having much more of a dialogue-based relationship and an ethical-based regulatory framework, with the need for there to be a set of rules, and if companies break those rules in certain circumstances, they are going to have to be held to account. As well as that, a public environment, particularly in relation to the press, where something has to be done.
Thank you, Richard.
Reasonably similar to the University of Chester. You've talked, in fact, about the whole question of reflecting what the public expects. You've also talked about becoming involved in corporate governance issues. And the question in my mind is, to what extent, when the public starts to demand that there is an enhanced regard for sustainability or for any other aspect that's not yet in the corporate governance rules, is it legitimate for the regulator to try and reflect that in the guidance that's given to the companies?
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to answer Richard's question first, and then I'll come on to the field. But you're right, they do link. And before I start, I am going to out you, Mr. Calvi. So for those of you who don't know who Richard is, until fairly recently, Richard was our Senior Director of Customers and Casework, and I kind of feel like he's testing me on the casework strategy. No? Okay.
Maybe.
No, but it's an important point, and you know, you everybody in this room, I'm sure, is familiar with the principles of sort of ethical regulation and the fact that sort of underlying the idea of ethical regulation is the idea that actually, you know, fundamentally human beings want to do the right thing, and if regulators can help to create conditions that enable them to do the right thing, you get, if you like, self-generated compliance rather than that sort of assumption that, you know, those that you regulate will always be trying to do the wrong thing, and it's your job to collect lots of information and monitor them and beat them up if they do the wrong thing in order to prevent the inevitable happening. And I can see why you're saying that is, to some extent, there's a tension between that and some of the formal enforcement stuff. But as you know, I don't think in reality there is that tension. And I think, you know, what you do is you see regulators using all of the tools available in the toolkit. So, and you can see it in what we're doing. We're being really, really clear, increasingly clear, with companies about what good looks like, and what really, really challenging ideas of good looks like. We are working with companies to call out best practice and give them examples of people they can talk to. There was a customer data event that we organised this morning where we were trying to do that. We were saying, you know, we think that there's lots more you can do with customer data. Here are some people who've done it, so you can talk to them and find out more. So we do all of that good stuff. We also oversee behaviour within a set of rules and regulations. Where companies step outside those rules and regulations, we need to think very carefully about what we do. And in some cases, if you're pragmatic about it and you say what we're really trying to achieve here is the right behaviour, the right thing to do may not be to reach for the big hairy enforcement toolkit. The right thing to do might be to reach for the phone and pick it up and have a conversation with somebody that says, what are you thinking? We do a bit of that. But where you see cases that are big, where you see cases that are persistent, where you see cases that are systemic, where you see cases where there is really serious customer harm, where, for example, something like a Competition Act case might open up third-party damages that are really worth having, then you think very seriously about whether you do get out of the big hairy enforcement toolkit. And all that does is it increases the power that you have when you come to use the informal toolkit later on. So there is a complementarity here, and I certainly don't think, and I know Chris Hodges doesn't think this either, but you know, if you're trying to pursue an ethical regulatory set of principles, that it means putting away the enforcement toolkit, because it doesn't. That absolutely underpins it. And then coming on to your question about corporate governance, as I said in my lecture, the other thing that does underpin that idea of ethical regulation is, I think, having a really, really good set of corporate governance principles that are acted on within companies, so that as the regulator, you aren't just trusting to luck that companies are going to want to do the right thing. You have the evidence about how those companies take decisions. You have the evidence about the levers within the companies and how they're being used. So when you sit back and say, well, okay, I am confident that you're going to want to do the right thing, you've kicked the tires on it. You've got some expectations there that are based on reality. Now, of course, that does take you into corporate governance issues, and I completely accept that this is not traditional economic regulatory territory. Completely accept that. But I do think it's enormously important, and in fact, I mean, I'm sitting here, obviously, speaking about things very much from an Ofwat perspective today. One of the changes that happened in our legislative framework in 2014 was the Water Act, and that gave us a new statutory duty. And that new statutory duty is around the resilience of systems and services. We have a duty now to further the resilience objective, and resilience is about systems and services. Now, as far as we're concerned, the systems and services that we need to look at the resilience of are as much about corporate governance as they are about assets and their operation, because they are as big a part of how companies work and what they are delivering and why they do what they do as the state of the assets in the ground. So I think we absolutely have a remit to go there, but I completely accept that it's new territory, and it's territory where we do tread carefully. It's territory where we talk a lot to others who have more experience than we do, and we are very much trying to take the sector along with us. And to be fair, I think by and large right now that's working.
Hi, Mark Hinton from Servalac Technologies. We half of what we do as a business is for the National Health Service, looking after their data, so the ransomware day was a very interesting one for us, and we successfully weathered that. And I was at the earlier event today about value for customers through data and open data. I was a little concerned to see that data security came so far down the list of concerns in the room for the vote. And I'm wondering, those areas where there's a span across between regulators that are at a national level, such as cyber security, and I'm also thinking about the energy challenge that lies ahead of us and having more flexible power systems controlled from the centre while still guaranteeing what needs to be done for security of, you know, supply regionally. I wondered what your thoughts were on the role of the regulator of Ofwat in that space.
Mm. I mean, I think...
Would you prefer
one-on-one,
or do you prefer...
You could take two or three.
Okay, shall you... Yep.
Okay.
Hi, it's Carmen Loveday from the Water Report. I just wondered if I could press you a little on your closing comments around open-mindedness to structural change combined with multi-utility bundling and multifaceted consumers. So can you say whether you actually see a trajectory towards multi-utility regulation?
Shall I take those two? Or?
Okay, you two.
Right. Okay, so, point about data security. Yeah, I wasn't there for the very end of the event. I guess I would have been kind of surprised if data security was right at the bottom of the list as well, because it kind of underpins everything else. As the regulator in the water sector, we are taking a role in respect of data security and data more widely, as you saw us do today, of setting out the challenge to companies, getting issues on the table, provoking the conversation, putting people in touch with other people, facilitating those conversations. That's very much the stage that we're at the moment. I would not rule out us revisiting, for example, a review on resilience in relation to data at some future point, but I think we're not quite ready to do that yet. If we were to do that, then an obvious hookup is possibly with colleagues at Ofgem, certainly with colleagues at Ofcom, who have a statutory responsibility in respect of cyber security, for example. So, and that's the great thing about UKRN, is we have a ready-made network there to tap into when we do that, and there are conversations that happen on data security across that network as well. So more I think to do in that space, but watch this space and we'll get there. Yes, Karma, thank you for that invitation. Do I think multi-utility regulation is going to happen? I think in some ways it's absolutely inevitable. I mean, if you get evolutions in the products and services that markets provide, regulators must respond to that. And whether that brings about structural change, I think, matters less than whether regulators are actually really understanding the shifting dynamics in the market really understanding the issues in relation to customer protection, really understanding the issues in terms of how you enable service providers to compete and doing what they can. And I think, you know, one of the things that you might be aware of that we're doing already is, you know, we're already working with Ofgem, for example, because we can see in the business customer retail market in water, there are already, particularly through third-party intermediaries, some of those multi-utility bundles coming together. So it makes sense for us to talk to colleagues at Ofgem about the regulatory regime that they have in place, the regulatory regime that we have in place, where there might be some gaps, where there might be some overlaps, how do we make it all work better. Very much a work in progress, and we'll be able to the market in April. But I think multi-utility regulation is happening already and will happen. I wouldn't necessarily read across from that the inevitability of structural change, but as I said, open to it.
Two more questions, then two or three. but then we will come to a close. Yeah, okay.
Can we collect those?
Okay, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mike Robb, Water UK. You talked a lot about, and I think this applies to all of those as well, rather than just the opportunity to use more of the relationship-based tools alongside the traditional regulatory toolkit, and I get that. I wondered if you saw a tension between that dynamic and one of the key elements of independent regulation, the risk that actually regulation becomes more personalised, perhaps, as we in recent years. And if there is a tension, is it a problem?
Anthony Ferrer, SES Water. Catherine, if you mentioned the recent election, I wondered what you would have done on the nitrogen if you'd woken up to a Labour win, a Labour government. So what do you think that you as an independent economic regulator should do then? Just wondering if you could comment on that.
So Michael, dealing with your question first. Yeah, I absolutely do see that risk. I think there is a definite risk that in making more of those relationships aren't necessarily personal, and you end up personalising regulation. And I don't think it's the reality, and in a sense, I don't think it ever could be the reality, particularly since, you know, we moved in the early 2000s away from the DG structure to the board structure. But I certainly think there is a risk that it is perceived in that way, and it's one that we need to manage. There are huge upsides, though, from building personal relationships between regulator and regulated companies, to the extent that it enables the regulator to get beyond engaging at the chief exec level, the chairman level, and the regulation director level, and actually sees you build a richer understanding of what's actually happening in the company. So, I mean, you know, I mean, you can see us at the moment trying to encourage various people within Ofwat to talk more to strategy directors, finance directors, asset management directors, and people like that. So there is an upside in building those personal relationships because it gives you a richer understanding and a richer source of information. But you have to be really, really careful not to fall into the perception of personalisation. And also, you know, not to fall into the perception of having been captured by the companies that you regulate. So there are all those dangers there, but go in with your eyes open. Leaving your question to last, Anthony, thank you. I think when push comes to shove, and I said it in the lecture, we operate within a public policy context that's set by government. And if Labour had won the election, then they could quite rightly claim to have a mandate for the policies that were very clearly set out in their manifesto, one of which was, if people haven't noticed, renationalisation of the water sector. I suspect that our role at that point would have been very much working with colleagues in DEFRA to work out, you know, how one would do that, you know, how much it would cost, what would the process look like. Obviously, given our duties, we would have a very strong interest in how one would safeguard all of the benefits that privatisation and independent economic regulation have delivered for customers in that. I think we would see ourselves having a key role there. I think the other thing to say, again from my own experience, is I don't think there is any necessary consequence of renationalisation that means the demise of economic regulation. I spent years working at the rail regulator. you know, Network Rail landed back on the public balance sheet at that point, we still have an economic regulator that is independent of government, but the relationship changed, and because it was public funds going in, because it was public policy that the industry was trying to deliver, there was a much stronger role for government there in saying what government wanted to buy from the rail industry. But the regulator was still given the space to operate as an independent regulator, to do its price review, work out how those things were best delivered, price them up, build in the efficiency challenge, and hold the sector to account. So I don't think I was looking at it as an existential crisis, but I think I was looking at some interesting analytical challenges.
I'm most certainly not experiencing an existential crisis right now, but rather I think we've just had 70 minutes of an extremely stimulating discussion and many points which will be debated in the future of months and years, possibly until our retirement. So first of all, thank you all very, very much for coming. Please stay and drink, be merry, and eat lots of snacks. But most of all, thank you, Catherine, for making yourself available for giving such a serious talk, sets the agenda, and also for coming here to do that. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Catherine.